The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
And absolutely delighted to introduce our next guest from the iconic Irish Celtic rock band Horselips. They've recently released a 4-CD and a DVD set containing rare material from the archives of the BBC. Barry Devon, Horselips bass player, singer, frontman, screenwriter, and so much more, joins me now. Barry, how are you today?
The word iconic, I should warn you, viewers, means almost dead.
I don't, combined age greater than Stonehenge. I hope there is no truth in that at all. I'll give you my theory, which I've been hatching on the basis of something that you told me, or you said in an interview a few years back. I'll give you that in a moment. But this is gorgeous. Tell us more about this. The Horselips at the BBC.
Yeah, it's actually, it's lovely. It's worth stunning. It for the book alone. I mean, Colin Harper and Mark Cunningham are kind of, we're just lucky to have these two guys, one of whom is an extraordinary graphic artist, illustrator and designer, and one of whom is Colin Harper. And enough said, you know, who genuinely is iconic. He's a brilliant writer. He has a book called Irish Folk Trad and Blues, which is one of the great chronicles of Irish music.
I think I know the man who wrote the intro for that.
Yeah, I mean, he's... I use Irish Folk Trad and Blues to try and remember where I was in 74.
Sensational book. Yeah. Can I say again, you mentioned graphic design. Graphic design has always been at the core of Horselips, isn't it? From the word go.
Yeah. We had a graphic designer who occasionally played fiddle, concertina and mandolin called Charles O'Connor. And he was, you know, right from the start, we were an independent record label before anyone thought there was such a thing as an independent record label. And so Charles designed everything, including our clothes. And he always put me in a big yellow suit.
How did you feel about that? Well, another man tells you what to wear.
Yeah, you know, no, absolutely.
How are you?
None of them succeeded. I was still famously the worst dressed man in Dublin. I mean,
he had fairly extreme tastes as well, green lizard suits and things. Yeah. You know, it wasn't as if he just asked you to wear a suit and tie.
Yeah, the thing about Charles was he came from art college in England, Middlesbrough. And so when he got off the boat, he was like a drawing of what an art college student is. He was like Stuart Sutcliffe on steroids. We couldn't believe him. We just kept looking at him. You know, on occasion, we'd carry him around.
Oh, that was so important, though, because when people looked at you, you looked like a band. You looked the way a band should be. You know, that made sense. Then you were an original band on top of that. And then, the first album sleeve was just genius. The concertina shape. It was just, it was the talking point of the time. It really was phenomenal.
Yeah, it was, because we the other thing that was important about us was we were all non-Dubliners.
Yeah.
And so we were cordially loathed by every Dublin muso. I don't blame us, them. I mean, here we were lads from places like Kells, I give you, and Arbo, you know,
that should only be up here on December the 8th. Yeah. And then only for 12 hours.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so here, and suddenly, you know, 4 months or 5 months or a year after you first hear the name, there's this album out, which is the shape of a concertina.
Amazing.
And all this stuff. And so it all happened very
quickly. I'll give you my theory in a moment. But during all that time, you were being invited into the BBC to do sessions, were you? Because you were together. Taking its, you know, having a go at it from 72 up to 80. That was the first golden era. So all during that time, you were getting your foot in the door with the BBC, because the BBC, it was a hard nut to crack, wasn't it?
It was. The hard nut was actually getting our singles to be hits.
Sure.
In fact, the BBC were very good to us. John Walters and, the Peels. Peel wasn't that mad about us, because Peel would have been at the Tommy Potts. Peel would have been very purist.
Okay.
And he would have gone, yeah, these guys are messing about with the stuff and I know the stuff.
Yeah.
But his producers kind of liked us because we were kind of funny. And there was still, even though needle time restriction, the 18 hours of recorded material that the BBC were allowed to play, even though that restriction had gone in 67 or 68 when Tony Blackburn and the boys started invading the airwaves, they still, the tradition of recording bands meant that you could play them as often as you wanted once you used the recording.
Sure.
So Jarrig Doom, the Jarrig Doom and Fast and the Hound that we do on the Old Grey Whistle Test, was actually recorded in, you know, it's not the album track.
It's a
copy of the album track.
But they have brilliant engineers, didn't they?
Fantastic.
And brilliant equipment.
Yeah.
So you very often get a better version of your actual track from them, wouldn't you?
Some would say. And
but the Kings used to say it.
Yeah.
The Kings used to say the BBC sessions of Lola and all those things were better than their own recording.
No, and that's entirely possible because by the time you went into Delaware Road to do your recording, you already knew the stuff backwards.
Yeah, yeah.
You had a limited time to do it. So you had you had a certain urgency about it, whereas you might have been a week and a half in Escape or wherever, lolling about, you know.
Still, still working out the track. So you've got it, the vinyl is absolutely gorgeous. You've got Radio 1 in Concert from 1974, and that has You Can't Fool the Beast and The March. And then you've another radio concert, that's more of the same one. Then Sounds of the 70s, they're mostly concerts, are they?
There's a lot of stuff there. One of the interesting ones for me is Melvin Bragg, who did Second House. And the production team came over here and we went all around Wicklow in the white Range Rover. And it was, Bragg was interested in us because unlike Peel, he didn't know about Tommy Potts. So this was his...
You can know first, too much sometimes.
No, and so this is his first introduction to people messing about with Irish music. So we loved that. And that's a really interesting documentary to watch.
Yeah.
If you can bear my preening, it's certainty.
It's preening to you. It's genius to the rest of us. And also collaborations with the Ulster Orchestra as well. That's seriously beautiful stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That was a lot of fun. That was the one where Charles turned round to the orchestra and said, "I've been counting, and there are 27 people on this stage who play their instruments better than I do." Which is very Charles.
And he probably wasn't wrong.
No, that was
a very intimidating thing to play with an orchestra.
The thing about playing with the orchestra is it's like having a big train set.
Yeah.
There'd be two bass players back there, and a bunch of man. It was great. And the orchestras were lovely. We did the same thing in the National Concert Hall later on with the very great Brophy. Yeah. So with it's Brian Byrne in Belfast,
it's like a little history document, isn't it? You've whistle test sessions and all that.
Yes,
it's beautiful.
Yes, all of.
Did
all
you
of
know it. About all this? Or did this kind of come as a bit of a surprise to you?
No, completely. Colin Harper. don't let Colin Harper near your house because he'll find stuff about something happens that you didn't know happened.
Amazing. And you're going to be in the Record Shop here in Dublin, Spin Dizzy.
The process of shilling goes on relentlessly at all times.
And if they bring in their Horselips, their albums, you're happy to sign them.
And it's a meet and greet. You don't have to bring in anything. We're going to be in Spin Dizzy at 1 o'clock. And if we don't want to repeat the screen from Spinal Tap where we have to kick the A&R man, we need some people to come along.
Please go. Now, I want to go to my theory. I saw a documentary with you, the Maurice Linnan one, Dancehall Sweethearts. There's a moment in it where you get quite animated, saying that in 1972 in Ireland there was nothing. When I did a bit of dive, you were on the money. Why was there so little? There was 650 show bands. There was Van, Rory, and Gilbert O'Sullivan having hits, and then there was nothing.
Yeah.
How was this?
The Bachelors. It was to do with the condition the country was in. We still were in the 50s, we really were. I mean, it wasn't that long since Whitaker had kind of gone, in the 50s.
The Economist, the man who was advising.
Who actually put together the economic plan that saved us all. In the 50s, we were losing 50, 60,000 people every year from a small population, just getting on boats and going to England with no hope. So, and there was no plan. And in fact, there was widely sort of circulated talk that we maybe would be better going back and joining Britain again. It was mooted very seriously because the state had failed. It had failed its people. It couldn't feed them. It couldn't give them jobs. It had a rural economy, which was basically fire a couple of bullocks out into the backyard. And now you're a beef farmer. So it took Lamass and Whitaker together to go, we need an industry that, the middle firms thing that propelled Germany in the 50s and 60s. And they got that business together.
So when the 60s were going on throughout the rest of the world with Dylan and the Beatles and the Stones, we had the show bands.
Yes.
And the covers, you know, great show of Anne's, the Capital and the Royals.
We had a uniquely Irish solution to a uniquely Irish problem, which was the uniquely Irish problem was being rural and Irish. And the solution was going to a show band any day of the week.
So this is where it gets interesting, though. Into this comes Horselips. Because you're instantly successful with that first album, you're going into the show band's world. And people are going along and seeing you and seeing an original band and doing cool things with Irish music. And lights are going on in their heads, aren't they?
Yes, this was true. It's important to point out, though, that Michael Deeney, our very cunning and fur coat dressed manager, spotted that what rock bands did, or what beat groups did, as they were called, was they played tennis clubs and basements and Leeson Street. That was it. That was as far as they went. He looked out there and he went, there are all these big empty halls and Horselips could play in them. And he sent us out to play in them. And, you know, it's axiomatic that we broke big out of Clara.
And when you go through all of the people who are influenced by this, like John Kelly writes about it, the Edge's first ever gig is you guys in Skerries. His first ever festival is Roy Gallagher and you guys.
Yeah.
In McCroom.
Pat McCabe. I mean, McCabe's whole world is predicted around a thing that has Horselips somewhere in the centre of it. And, you know, it's a mutual admiration society. But Pat McCabe always says that what Horselips did was it gave an objective correlative to the world he imagined, that he could go down to Rock Corrie and see something that looked a bit like the world that he thought was out there somewhere, if he could only get out of Rock Corrie. Yeah. And so we were like a food truck that rolled into the village and would give you stuff that was a bit like the real stuff that you could get in England and America.
You're like missionaries going around Ireland.
Yeah.
Bringing music. And then when you see things moving on, I mean, I don't know if you can make the connection, but Thin Lizzy had more or less crashed around the time of Whiskey in the Jar. And apparently in the room when they were discussing, will we do this, there was, well, Horselips are doing well. You know, they're doing a bit of Irish stuff going on. So that did swing Phil's head into releasing Whiskey in the Jar, which is the single that saved them.
It was. I mean, although they didn't take it seriously. I mean, it was.
They hated it,
exactly. Yeah. And I think Phil spent the rest of his life trying to pretend that he really hadn't done Whiskey in the Jar, he'd done Jailbreak.
Yeah.
You know, we were interested in what he was up to.
Sure.
And we already knew Phil from the days when, you know, he used to come down to Eamon Carr's Poetry Society in the Pembroke and read his poetry and play. And I mean, he was clearly kind of sensitive and shy.
He's reinvented, though, after the success of that. He gets the two guitar Thin Lizzy thing going after that, which changed it. But you go forward a few short years and you've gone from 650 show bands, three original artists and you, to suddenly this explosion of original artists. Bob Geldof on Top of the Pops, you two out of the Traps, which you're instrumental in helping. Their demo tapes, their videos.
Yeah. And I mean,
it's good,
you know, I've kind of always said that we were kind of an elegant cul-de-sac. You know, I mean, the Debussy thing, people kind of liked it and didn't do anything at all like it. I mean, you two owe nothing to us, the Boomtown Rats owe nothing to us, except a suggestion that Ireland could produce its own music and make it important.
That is, you are, I put it to you, Barry, you are the source of the Nile. Spin Dizzy Records, 1 o'clock.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.